for plebs by plebs, dropping the Bitcoin only signal. Pleb Underground. Welcome everyone to the Pleb Underground.
Welcome back to Pleb Underground. Episode 79 of Pleb Underground, new ATH in dollars, euros, pound. I speak properly, but not made in Chelsea. My ends always tight, but not played like Kelsey. I provoke a reaction, cause a displacement, invoke a reaction with each displacement. Shitcoin is like graffiti defacement, permanent inscription awaiting a debasement. Learn more tech, advancing Bitcoin, earn more heck, not chancing Bitcoin, burn more neck, not dancing Bitcoin, yearn more check, rot enhancing Bitcoin. He loves Bitcoin like two in a tryst, only UTXOs, Satoshis don't exist. Time to set sail, but I ain't made 3 milli. I'm not a whale, but she wants to free Willy. Another Bitcoin, guard one and hold. I'm the Bitcoin bard, the one that's bold. I don't like origami girls, just ones that fold. Influenced by my world, found one to mold. Just let me cook and you get doled. You're on the hook, once we met, sold. Reality not a book, aim high, not rolled. Up, I just blaze, don't care for opinion polled. Price already pumping, before cutting supplies. Why is it jumping? Is it a surprise? Plenty on Twitter just wants surmise, but I'm the real deal, not just her prize. The bear is dead, long live the revenant. Full greed and lust, just 2 of 7 cent. It's a marathon, not a sprint, but you better stay agile. Cut stone like a flint, if she's wet to play a while. Have no barney like rubble, diet carny, no trouble. For her to grip, cream, flow like slipstream. Pull out, can't abort, plan bull, route, plant a portland.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Pleb Underground YouTube show, episode 79. We have a very special episode. We're going to change things up. That's right. Joining us today, we've got Portland Hoddle. Portland Hoddle, for the people who don't know who Portland is, he's open source and Bitcoin contributor and apparently a marathon captured spook. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it and very excited to be here and kind of discuss Bitcoin. And I'm assuming one of the other topics will be what I'm doing at Marathon or even why I'm doing it for that matter.
Absolutely. And the plebs want to know. There's been a lot of questions, right? Like, you know, you're in the Twitter sphere and for some reason, Portland went from being, you know, very well loved to all of a sudden, you know, the... I keep thinking of that monkey meme with the eyes flashing back and forth, or the Fry meme, you know, with the stare, the puzzling stare. It's what's Portland doing over there at Marathon anyways? Okay. Anyways, look, we're going to get into that. But before we do that, we are first going to dive into the numbers. Let's do it. The numbers, of course, are brought to you by Time Chain Stats. And of course, our newest sponsor, well, not our newest sponsor, but our second newest sponsor to the show, BTC Prague, an absolutely awesome conference that takes place every year in Prague. It is the biggest and best Bitcoin conference in Europe. Get your tickets. Check the links down below in the show notes. Use the code PLEB for 10% off. And if you pay in Bitcoin, you get an additional 5% off. That's at btcprague.com. Check it out. At the time of this recording, the block height is, I was about to say the Bitcoin price. Anyways, the block height is 835,103. The Bitcoin fiat exchange, 68,081.53. Total public lightning capacity, 4,659. That's right, guys. Plus or minus 34 days to the halvening. Fastest fee, 13 sats per V-byte. The ordinals just aren't doing what they're supposed to do. And guys, the chain rewrite days are 6:60 and Moscow time, 1468. Gotta tell you, saw some pretty disappointed people on Bitcoin Twitter in the last couple of days because we've had this micro dip and apparently Bitcoin is dead at 67K. Now, Portland, before we get into the terrible things that Marathon is doing in the Bitcoin mining space, what are your thoughts on Bitcoin being dead at 67? Is it over? Are we all just packing it up and going home?
I mean, to pump my own bags later on, yeah, it's completely dead. There's no way it's coming back. The signature algorithms are all broke. Be careful. Next block might not come in. But that's not the reality, right? The Bitcoin network is operating as expected. Blocks are coming in on average every 10 minutes. The last difficulty adjustment happened. We saw a little bit of positive action there. Bitcoin is operating exactly as it should. And as such, Bitcoin will continue to survive and continue to do well. For that matter, I do personally want to dip, obviously, to accumulate more coins at a lower price. With that said, yeah, it's doing great. There is Bitcoin is certainly not dead. It's been called dead at $800. It's been called dead at $13. It's been called dead apparently at $68,000. So when you hear it's dead, check the network itself to see if it's dead. Not because you're hearing talking heads from legacy media telling you it's dead. It is most certainly not dead. It will continue to survive in one form or another, basically forever.
You know what? Since we're flipping the script on this episode, I'm actually just thinking. I see a lot of these tweets from guys like, I don't know if you follow or see the account Dot Kruger, the TradFi guy that loves Bitcoin. But hey, let's talk about shitcoins. I don't know if you've ever seen him.
No. Rule is I only follow plebs. I do not follow any big accounts on Twitter. No Michael Saylors. None of that. I want my signal coming right from the bottom. The people I want to buy Bitcoin. Not the people trying to capture it up top.
So I appreciate that. I definitely appreciate that. I also I do my best not to follow these massive accounts. Like I don't follow Sailor and I don't follow that Dot Kruger account either. But unfortunately, he does pop up in my feed, and he is talking about all of a sudden this garbage Thor chain, and more specifically, forget about the tokens. Let's just talk about yield on Bitcoin. Okay, what are your thoughts? To me, I feel like it's going to be the same shit as what they tried to do with shitcoins, except they're going to pretend that it's done on Bitcoin, right? It's still going to be the whole you give me your Bitcoin thing and we're going to have you accumulate this shitcoin, but then you sell this shitcoin to get more Bitcoin back. I don't know. I think it's the same.
The grift is always going to be the same, 100%, because Bitcoin is mathematically finite. As such, there is no concept of guaranteed yield through dilution, which is the only way shitcoins can obtain yield is by diluting the existing shareholders, right? So with Ethereum, you have to mint more of the coin to dilute somebody out, or a secondary contract. It's always dilution. Anybody that's trying to do yield on Bitcoin will find that dilution is impossible, because the only way you can dilute in Bitcoin is currently mining. You can only get 6.25 Bitcoin that dilute the existing Bitcoins every 10 minutes by burning megawatts of energy. It's very difficult to dilute in Bitcoin. And that dilution ratio in about 30, how many days was it till the halving? Like 30 or 20?
34, something like
34
that.
34 days, yeah. 34 days.
Squiggly line.
Everybody's going to get diluted by about half as much every 10 minutes and until there is absolutely no more dilution on Bitcoin. And I read a book a long time ago called The Richest Man in Babylon. And it talked about, yes.
Good book.
I saw that. Fantastic book. It talked about lending and yield. And it laid out the most simple concept in the entire world, and especially even in crypto. Where is the yield coming from? The yield in Bitcoin, if anybody promises you, you can just sit on your thumbs and they're just going to take care of your yield. Who is paying the yield to them for them to take care of the yield that they're giving you? Because at the end of the day, the only way you can obtain yield on Bitcoin is by producing some sort of value where you can get people to give you their Bitcoins and have a monetary velocity. That is actually extremely difficult on Bitcoin, but not impossible. That means the real interest rate of lending Bitcoin out is going to be probably very high. But maybe, Coin Icarus, maybe I have some sort of construction company and you believe in my project in the development area I'm in. I got a bulldozer and all this stuff, but I need this new crane to build these big skyscrapers. You, with your tens of thousands of Bitcoin, go, okay, these skyscrapers will house people. Yes, correct. House people and all the stuff. And I'll be able to basically use this for business operations and collect rent. This might work for me. I'm willing to give Portland 500 of those Bitcoins to buy the cranes he needs to build those. But Portland, after you're done, you need to run this enterprise and give me back 5% on this loan, or basically make me whole. You're taking on a substantial risk. I have to produce a product. And I got to earn back your yield on that. But how do I do that? How do I get that yield? Physical molecules and atoms, goods and services. Mm-hmm. It's not TradFi. Let's just go into the SQL database or these other chains. Let's just create a smart contract where I have control of this specific entity. And then I can just conjure these things out of thin air to obtain yield. Hex being one of the ultimate examples of crap yield, right? Like literally, it's just Hex is
it's numbers on the screen.
It's numbers on the screen. Yield through dilution. That is it. Like, if you want the ultimate example of like how yield destroys things, go look at Hex.
Speaking of which, oh, I'm sorry, go on.
So yeah, just concluding that little segment. Yield does not exist anywhere in terms of real yield that's beneficial to society, unless it's being done through goods, services, molecules and energy, like things actually happening. Financialization of yield by spreadsheets or the yield gained from inflation, like the United States dollar and these other currencies, that is a net negative to everybody that isn't the one creating that yield that dilutes everybody else. The Cantillon effect, as you may have heard. The first people to touch that new yield get to spend that new yield at full value. But by the time that yield ends up at the secondary hands, the third hands, and this includes your crap shit coins, I'm just going to say it. By the time it gets that far, by the time it gets that far down the chain that your exit liquidity, the normie is buying it, that has absolutely no value. It is gone by that point. They have lost their investment. So they've been diluted. Okay.
Oh no, very well said. And just one final point on Hex before we dive into the fireside chat that's going to be all Portland. The last point on Hex I want to make, interestingly enough, right? Richard recently came out with he put out a tweet explaining that, right, his eHex, right, the new Hex, which is not Ethereum Hex, which is the one on Pulse Chain, that's the real Hex. So yep. Anybody still holding the original one that he had touted originally as real is now no longer real, and it's so sad because he's a very good speaker. He is charismatic. Okay, like when you listen to him speak, he's energetic. It's enticing, right? It's so this is what people don't understand. Okay, and they get fooled. They get fooled by magnetic personalities. Okay, like and he is a great example of a magnetic personality. But also at the same time, if you listen to what he does, he has a way of getting you to believe that he is teaching you, when he explains things. So very, very crafty. Anyways.
Yeah. Richard Hart specifically. Him specifically. It's always like, as much as I do, like, he is an absolute shame for a person. Like he conned people out of money.
Total grift.
But it was always one of my dreams to argue or debate him on Bitcoin because he is so well-versed and he's extremely technically proficient on all the little CVEs, the inflation bug, the 0.7 to 0.8, and telling you all these things about, well, Bitcoin could have the same thing. Well, Mr. Hart, have you thought about your protocol and the fact it runs on top of another protocol, Ethereum, that also has had notorious social consensus issues, et cetera, with that? Like, how do you guarantee your contract is going to execute correctly in perpetuity for your end users? And the other thing about Richard Hart specifically, other than just being, like you said, just this personality, I think a lot of people that are in very poor financial conditions or maybe in decent financial conditions, look at him and see him taking the trips to the Louis Vuitton store, the Gucci store, his cars, all this stuff, and think, I could do that. If I just learned what he did, like you said, the teaching aspect, and that's a scam. They were all the people that bought into this were paying for that stuff for him. Meanwhile, they ended up losing 99%, actually. So,
you know what? I know that we think that it's greed that drives us, but I recently read, I don't remember which book it is. It's not greed that drives us. It's envy. And it's to your point, right? Because what did he do? Greed on its own, nobody can want what you have if they don't see what you have, if you don't make them want what you have. So it is envy, because what did he do, right? He went around, did a whole bunch of media promotion showing how, quote unquote, because again, I think it's to each their own. I don't really consider what he was doing living well, but in his eyes and his brand, look at how well I'm living. Look at these expensive things I'm buying. You know, and by virtue of that, it creates envy. And then people want to, you know, some people want to replicate that. And they think that that's success. It's too bad. We have a long way to go. Humanity has a long way to go.
One last thing about Richard Hart specifically. So like, if you looked at his profile before the SEC started getting involved with kind of the Hex thing, the first line of his bio, holder of the world's largest diamond. That was the first thing. I am the guy who owns the world's most, the largest diamond. And diamonds are very precious to a lot of people. How did that man get that thing? I want that thing. And he also had the Rolex Daytona, the rainbow, which is a watch that's worth more than most people's houses, right? Just saying, there's a lot of excellent liquidity to get to that point. And people see that and they get very jealous of that, especially because the people buying these things are thinking these cryptos and all this stuff, it's not money to them. It's an investment. It's this Rube Goldberg machine that you buy to then turn into more dollars. Okay, moving forward. Sorry.
Pleb Underground is brought to you by BTC Pins. Check them out at btcpins.com. Awesome Bitcoin themed pins made by a fellow Bitcoiner. Use the code Pleb Underground for 5% off. Absolutely amazing pins. Check out my collection. You know which one's my favorite. Guys, use the code Pleb Underground for 5% off at btcpins.com. Welcome back, everyone. That's right. We're full of confusion. Walton is back. And of course, joining us today, we've got Portland Hoddle. And Portland, so look, we're gonna dive right into it. I originally found your account probably like a few years ago, or I think I originally experienced you on Spaces. And I noticed right away that you were really good at explaining very technical things very simply. And that is something that
is...
Yes, in a humble way, which is very refreshing, right? And
quite rare.
Yeah, rare and helpful. So, but then something happened. You started getting interested in Bitcoin heavily, and you started writing code, and somehow... you created a Slipstream at Marathon, and something changed. The plebs got afraid. What happened? There was like a backlash. There was a whole bunch of people that loved Portland, and then all of a sudden they're like, "Hey, Portland, what have you done?" So, let's dive into it. Tell us essentially, right, like how you stumbled into, you know, starting to write code and the relationship with Marathon, and then we have a tweet that we want to take a look at. Together.
Why are you trying to make Marathon's mempool more promiscuous? Like, you're just opening it up to any sort of fuckery.
Yeah, as long as that is consensus valid, we will accept those transactions for a higher than market rate fee, because the mempool is always a place for the highest bidder to buy block space. That's the market that Satoshi created, was for block space.
So the logic is, if you're a prostitute, you should just accept the highest bidder, irrespective of what they're going to do to you, because, you know, you got to get paid, and, you know, you've only got so much space. You might as well just take the highest bidder for that space.
Yeah. In terms of a miner, if you want to reference it against that, yeah, to act rationally, miners should always be trying to maximize the number of Bitcoins they're earning for the fact of just survival, right? Mining is a survival of the fittest. You can compete on power costs, ASIC efficiency, and the amount you're earning per block. Those are really all you can do. As such, that's the only spot where I feel like I fit really well, that I could basically say that I have this idea, pitched it, and then kind of brought it into reality, that the relay policy should actually be closer to consensus. And then if people want to talk about and discuss filtering on Bitcoin, you shouldn't be doing it at the relay level. You shouldn't make a rule with inside the set of rules, just because you feel that like it's some special thing or there's some specific way to use Bitcoin. Bitcoin is programmable money that is only bound to the rules of consensus. And when you talk about limiting Bitcoin in any specific way, that needs to happen at the consensus level. The relay level should only be to protect nodes from actual DOS vectors. And what I mean by DOS is denial of service. What thing would deny a node service? Like, how could you make a node stop operating? Believe it or not, after working with Slipstream, I actually got approached by different firms within the Bitcoin ecosystem, and they said, hey, you guys could cause a big problem for Bitcoin. And to which I went, I've kind of come up with a few solutions for the big ones I'm pretty sure you guys are going to bring up. And so I list off my things, and they go, okay, that's good, you got the big ones, but there are two primary problems. It's called the quadratic hash problem. And that is where, if somebody takes a transaction with legacy. So these are the addresses begin with the number one and the number three, and they use thousands of inputs. Okay. So they do like 3,000 inputs on a transaction. And for example, maybe a giant consolidation. So they have 3,000 of these old UTXOs hanging out, and they want to bring them all to one. That's a very big problem in Bitcoin. Legacy scripts like that, or legacy Bitcoins, require a lot of processing power that's squared. So the total number of operations the node has to do is 3,000 times 3,000. So you end up with this big, big array of operations. And that is what is known as the first like kind of big attack on Bitcoin from a miner that actually did a DOS. And that was F2Pool. They mined one of these, and it's called the 12-second block. And the reason why it's called the 12-second block is because as you're doing this initial block download, you go through all the blocks, and then you hit that block with F2Pool, where they took in one of these transactions and mined it. And your node takes 12 seconds to process this block. All the other blocks are just like milliseconds. Just connect, 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 connect. And then you hit this F2Pool block, and it's literally 12 seconds to process it. And so as part of Slipstream, I had to explain, I basically limited the number of inputs so people could do this. Because if you have a low number of inputs, even if you square it, it's not going to do a lot of damage. It's only when you get to those big numbers, it's exponents, right? So it becomes very big and very problematic. And then there's also the ye olde opcode separator that's been hanging around in Bitcoin since the beginning. And you can use that in some nasty ways to create blocks that actually take much longer than even the 12 seconds to validate. As such, Slipstream has disabled the ability for users to do opcode separator in the service. So yeah, that is part of that. There are actual attacks on nodes that involve relay policy. You should filter those out because that's a problem until you can fix the consensus to do that. But the fact that somebody wants to use data on Bitcoin, that is not an attack vector because of the fact that how does one differentiate the virtuousness of BlackRock using up 4 megabytes of data for their financial consolidations and all their ETFs versus a JPEG versus a pleb doing a transaction? It's not my job to play data police, right? My job is to ensure Bitcoin is censorship resistant and remains ungoverned by any rules other than consensus. And diving in even further, the ultimate mechanism to decide who is the most worthy for that block space needs to be the bid that they use to put into that block space. Like I am bidding 28 sats per V-byte and Phil, or sorry, Aquinia Chris.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't know if your dog's Phil. Okay. Okay. Just making sure. Okay. And you come in with, hey,
all good.
So you come in with, hey, I have 30 sats per V-byte. Obviously, I think my transaction is more important. So the Bitcoin network doesn't have this thing where it asks me again, hey, Portland, do you want to up your bid? No, we don't even know when the blocks are going to come in. Highest bid wins at the end of the day. I can't pick and choose whether or not your transaction is better or worse than mine based on the type of data.
But let me ask you, and it might just be a really simplistic take, but doesn't the introduction of a service like Slipstream, does this not create some type of a scenario where the consensus is hijacked, right? Like all of a sudden it's, no?
The consensus.
Because you're one of the miner, I guess, because you're going to the miner directly.
It fractures the mempool, but the mempool is not consensus.
Mempool fragmentation is the issue. It's more about like estimation of fees. So like you can, right now you can estimate the fees of a transaction to get it into the next block or in, you know, in the next 6 blocks or in the next 24 Correct. Hours based on what your node currently sees in the mempool or what the node of the wallet service provider you're using sees in the mempool. And if you have transactions that are getting mined by miners that aren't in the mempool, for example, those that use Slipstream, then you can't use the mempool accurately or as accurately for estimating your transaction fee if you want it to go into a particular, you know, next block or next few blocks or whatever it is. You still can use the like blocks that have already been mined. So if you look at the last few blocks that have been mined, you can kind of take an average based on that. And I think most people already sort of do that anyway. if you have one block that's full of a bunch of bullshit and there's a kind of arbitrary fee spike on that, that's still just like anomalous data, and you can kind of use the last few blocks anyway, excluding that, to kind of estimate your fees.
So the estimation does sometimes take into account previous blocks, but it should technically all be about what's in the mempool, because that's the only things that are competing. It doesn't matter that Marathon just mined a block full of a bunch of junk for 1.1 Bitcoin. You only got to look at the mempool at what comes next. What do these miners have to pick from, and what will these miners most likely take? As such, that's why mempool.space has one of the best algorithms for that, because they have a very well-connected mempool, and they do basically prioritize, okay, this is what the template should look like. These are the fee rates that are going to go in there. That's why mempool.space is kind of the go-to standard for what is the fee that I want to use right now. Even a lot of other applications use their API to get the fee rate. Quick question on this.
Oh. Is there an aspect of like a, you know the box packing concept? So from my understanding, and I tried to have a conversation with this but with some people in spaces, but I feel like maybe that they didn't have sufficient technical knowledge to argue the position properly. They're essentially it's just fees that get. No, but if you've got a small amount of space remaining.
You're totally cutting out, Walton.
You're cutting out.
Can you hear me? Really?
Yeah, you could sound good now, but before you're cutting really bad.
Yeah, before you're cutting now, you're okay.
Okay, let me try redo that bit.
Can I?
Do you want to 3-2-1 it, Phil, or?
Oh. Yeah, you could 3-2-1 it, but sorry, what were you gonna say, Portland?
I wanted to answer the mempool fragmentation thing just real quick, if that's okay, before we kind of jump to any bin packing things.
Okay.
And that is why Slipstream was okay to me to do with Marathon, and why I wouldn't do it with a service like Antpool. Because Marathon doesn't mine a lot of blocks. They're 2-3 a day right now, maybe 5 if they're lucky. But the fact is, just because one block has a bid that is higher, or somebody decides to use Slipstream, which it's not a consistent service, and there's not enough volume to distort the mempool with, first of all, the volume for Slipstream itself as a product, and then secondly, the other thing is the actual number of blocks. It's just too small to have any real impact. It has no, you can't go that, oh, wow, like Marathon totally hosed me on my fee estimation. I'm not going to get into a block anytime soon. My transaction's just too low below the threshold. But the service like Antpool, that's potentially possible if they're getting enough volume with that. And then the following thing I was going to say is that why does Marathon even have the opportunity to fragment mempool? It's because of these restrictive relay policies. If the relay policies met consensus, or consensus came down to the relay policies, people would just broadcast all these transactions on the regular network. They wouldn't even go to Marathon because Marathon's trying to get extra money from me, right? Screw that. I'm just going to broadcast across the gossip network that is Bitcoin. So at the end of the day, yeah, if you want to solve the fragmented mempool, just do away with the relay policy that is too restrictive. The relay policy should reflect market demand for block space, not some arbitrary like virtues or your own opinion on Bitcoin. Bitcoin is for your friends as it is for your enemies. Consensus should be the ultimate set of rules that everybody adheres to. And they always do at the end of the day. But the distorted view of what Bitcoin looks like in terms of the mempool is largely because of the difference, if you can consider it. It's not right now. Marathon doesn't do enough to do that. It is because of that difference between relay policy and consensus policy.
One, just briefly on this, I learned this week, I attended Advancing Bitcoin in London, and I learned that from a developer there that actually mempool, as in mempool.space, their accelerator program, they are essentially just an agency for like an intermediary for out of bound payments to mining pools or to miners. And so they were essentially there, or they are essentially just taking a cut of someone's payment, someone's out of bound payment, but only for certain transactions. So it's only for if you want to like bump the fee, and not for non-standard transactions, which is something that Slipstream does do.
Correct. Yeah. So mempool.space, basically it works in a very simple way, is that if your transaction shows up on mempool.space, and the only way it would show up on mempool.space is it's standard, right? It goes into their mempool. They allow you to click the accelerate button. They take their cut and they broadcast it to a set of miners that have accelerator programs. And then your basically your transaction ends up in a block. It is truly an acceleration service. Your transaction's taking too long. You can pay them to use their connections to boost that transaction's processing speed. That's all. So Slipstream is different in that it programmatically takes in anything that is consensus valid, other than the outlying scenarios that I mentioned. Like, hey, I am deliberately trying to use Slipstream to attack Bitcoin. That is not going to happen. But in terms of somebody just wants to craft a multi-sig that it puts the pub keys on chain, yes, absolutely, do it. I don't actually like pay to witness script hash multi-sig. You have to keep track of pub keys. I'd rather them just be on chain. So, and at the end of the day, if somebody wants to pay a fee to do that, that is fine. And we can keep going.
Pleb Underground is brought to you by CipherSafe. Check them out at CipherSafe.com. Absolutely awesome Bitcoin intricate art. That's right, guys. This is the Bitcoin Rollo Triangle. 16 ounces of solid titanium for all the pet rock lovers out there in Bitcoin. Check it out, the Bitcoin Rollo Triangle.
Just briefly, is there not an attack vector whereby miners can take out-of-band payments in fiat rather than in Bitcoin?
Absolutely. I don't know if it's... That is something we are not going into. That is not the purpose of Slipstream, and we'll go into even further like how Marathon receives payment for these things. But yes, absolutely. It can get so much worse, by the way. Like a miner technically could start accepting inscriptions and ordinals and all sorts of other things as well.
As payment.
As payment. Yeah. You could literally go like, hey, you could trade in you could dump your old inscription and get 100 bytes or a free transaction. And they just stack these inscriptions and they sell them on the open market. They could take social credit. Like, let's say some guy goes to them and says, hey, I'm able to fix the AC systems at your mining facility. Can you give me some block space in exchange for that? And you'll see a bunch of zero fee transactions because they traded block space for a real life good and service. That's the reality of it. You can pay for block space with social credit. Luxor, when they did that first Taproot wizard that was 3.76 megabytes, you noticed there was actually no fee on that. They traded that block space for the marketing they would get from doing that, the notoriety, and that the fact that, ironically, it played out really well for them. Luxor was a pretty small pool before that. And if you look at now, they're out punching Marathon in terms of the number of blocks they're producing per day. Like, it's pretty close, but compared to what it used to be, Mara used to be 5, and they used to be like under a sub 1%. And because of that, people got, they're on the map, they got the marketing on Twitter, and then even I watched plebs go from, they hated what Luxor was doing with ordinals and inscriptions, but when all of a sudden the payouts for Brains Pool started getting a little slow, their luck was a little bad, guess where they joined? They went right to Luxor because the payments were more continuous. Miners are short and medium term hodlers. Like they can't, they do think on longer time horizons, but they have cash flow. They need to be paying their bills and it's not free to buy. So inherently they are always looking for short term profits. And at that, they need to. That is the goal of it. If you break that incentive structure, Bitcoin breaks. The game theory is gone. If basically actors start policing or putting their own morals on what should be accepted and what's not accepted. That's the way governance works today. That's all.
So I believe you have a quantum cat that may be on or not on your shoulder right now. Another question about right now we have blacklisting of transactions, right? Things like OFAC style filtering is blacklisting of transactions, and you could argue that doesn't skew miner incentives as much as whitelisting transactions. If you give me a moment, I'll try to explain what I mean by this. So if right now, if you have say certain mining pools choosing not to filter transactions that are from Iran or North Korea or something like this, the consequence is that there will be or maybe Russia. There might be other mining pools that will mine those transactions. And certainly in the case of, like, I don't know, Russian billionaires, they're going to be willing to pay the fees. And so, mm-hmm. as a consequence, the ones that aren't filtering in an OFAC-style compliant way should be more profitable, and so therefore should be able to expand their mining operations greater, and so the Correct. Percentage of OFAC compliant pools should decrease over time. Now, what happens if we start getting whitelisting? This concept was introduced to me a little bit by the Dutch core contributor and longtime reviewer. Botched his name. It's like Sjors Provost. I met him this week. He said we could have a problem with the whitelisting of Bitcoin transactions if you have a whole bunch of mining pools that will only mine KYC transactions, will only mine blocks that have transactions in them from approved parties, rather than excluding like other ones, or maybe where you have certain mining pools that will only build their new chain on a chain that only has these KYC approved transactions. Can you talk a little bit about this attack vector and whether you think it's feasible and what sort of timeline this could be?
Yeah. So specifically, blacklisting and whitelisting are just two different ways of kind of saying the same thing. With whitelisting, basically you're saying that we're checking to make sure all of our customers are compliant. And with blacklisting, like your OFAC that you mentioned, that is basically you have a list of people that you know aren't allowed, but everybody else that isn't on that list is, no matter what. The reality is that without your second option, which was the orphaning of blocks, whitelisting would be incredibly unsuccessful because of the fact that basically, like your first scenario, the game theory plays out that, well, the people getting blacklisted that aren't whitelisted will just pay more fees to these other miners and their operation will basically become more profitable. And the operation that is whitelisting will become less profitable. And because mining is the efficiency game and survival of the fittest, it will basically decentralize away from that specific chain that is, or those specific miners that are whitelisting those transactions. Now, the orphaning scenario actually is what I'm deep down most concerned about for Bitcoin. Like, no, I don't mean to sound like scary or anything, because it's not, but there are only two existential threats to Bitcoin, in my own opinion. One, miner centralization. Mm-hmm. Two, is social consensus movements over long periods of time. Like, what Bitcoin mm-hmm. is changes very slowly, but it still does change. That is most of the time for the good. But occasionally we find out things that we don't really want Bitcoin to be doing that it now can do. So, but with that said, that point about whitelisting only works in, I joke, the current environment. Because of the fact that you have hash rate that is centralized enough that you could have a handshake go down between, for example, Foundry and Antpool to whitelist. And they could implement this policy that goes, well, if any of these miners from Kazakhstan or in South Africa or Brazil mine a block by any chance, we're going to orphan them. And no matter what, they statistically will outrun their chain. So it's basically you can perform censorship with 51% of the hash rate. That is currently two pools. What one nice thing, though, I've been watching is that share that those two pools have. It used to be like this on the pie chart, right? It's now like this. It's getting closer to below 50 as SecPool and these other pools kind of keep growing, and Luxor even for that matter, keep getting a little bit bigger. But with that said, it's optics at the end of the day. Like there, it's so incredibly centralized. These pools act like a single node. And what we've seen throughout history is that inherently we've seen periods where Bitcoin's centralized in terms of mining, and it kind of just self-regulates very naturally, which is great. But with Antpool and Foundry, the fact is that they're both jurisdictionally bound right now to the United States and China, respectively. And I don't think anytime soon that there would be a handshake, but yeah, there could be. And then the actual pools themselves, this is the ultimate saving grace. They don't own the hash rate. So a pool like Marathon owns all the hash rate. the hash rate can't go anywhere if they do something malicious. If Foundry and AMP will get together and do a handshake deal for a whitelist, what happens? The hash rate?
Minus switch pool, probably.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah. The only question you have to ask yourself is, what is the reality of these miner switching pools because of the industrial nature of the mining setups these days? To make a lot of hash rate, to get Foundry to where it is, to get AMP where it is, that hash rate, unfortunately, isn't coming from the guy running his S9 to heat his home. It's coming from shipping containers loaded with S21s yes. and S19s, just sucking wattage down from the local nuclear reactor and stuff. So with that said, they think about, yes, what they're doing is bad, but my payouts are still consistent. The value of Bitcoin, if it stays the same, they might just go, it's okay. That's what I'm worried about. And we saw this even with F2 pool. They got a lot of social pressure when they admitted to OFAC compliance. Chun backed off from that and even reversed the OFAC compliance of their pool. But if you actually look at the number of people that left the pool, it wasn't as high as what I thought it would be, because they control about like 15 to 18% of the hash rate. And they lost about 1% to 2% of their hash rate by pulling that move. That doesn't sit well with me to know that so many people would stick around and stick with a miner that is basically engaging with censorship. And the same thing kind of applies with Foundry and AMP, or AMP pool. How many of these miners would still stick with this pool, even if they're acting maliciously? I think the answer is higher than most would expect, but not all. So kind of concluding, a little bit of an off topic, but recently the United States administration has announced they're potentially threatening to tax Bitcoin miners in the US 30% extra on their power. I joke, do that, please. Get the miners out of the US. Get these things shipped out all over the world. Put them in Europe, put them in Africa, put them in South America. Get them out of here. Tax as much as you can, because ultimately, I don't want centralized miners. I don't want all the hash rate to come to the United States. As cool as it is for the United States, it's actually bad for Bitcoin to see this much hash rate controlled in the US. And any foreign nation that's like the hyper Bitcoinization thing of foreign nations are going to take in Bitcoin as their reserve currency will not happen if the United States controls the majority of hash because of that risk. Like, we showed the world in 2022 on February 28th, we will seize your dollars. If the United States controls the hash rate, technically at that point, you can start orphaning blocks and then start basically, you can't take the UTXO from that person, but you make that UTXO completely worthless until the moment that the United States loses that grip on that hash rate. So going down that rabbit hole, I don't think whitelisting works unless there's 51% of the hash rate. And two, jokingly, United States, tax the hell out of the miners. Get them out of here.
This is all right, very quick question on how we can prevent this. And then I think Phil's got a few questions and we're going to move on. But people run nerd miners. To me, it seems like a complete fucking waste of time. But there is this new thing called the BitTax, right? That essentially is they take an S19 that's got 330 chips in it. They take it apart into like one chip at a time. And it has similar or maybe even slightly better efficiency than the S19, and it's something that you can run at home. So you can get like 20, it's only like 20 joules per terahash. In the low 20s of joules per terahash is about the best efficiency right now for anything. And you can run it on normal power. So maybe everyone's running a BitTax, and I know like with the BitTax guys, or the UK BitTax guys called Solo Mining Company, come down to the meetup this week. They're also going to release something where it's got like 6 chips on. I was doing the numbers like initially, like if they're selling like one of these chips for $100, actually it's not good from like a hardware perspective in terms of like, to make that $100 back in Bitcoin terms. If you're only earning 40 sats a day, it takes almost 9 years, assuming no decrease in the your cut of the total global hash rate and no halvings. So that's not good. But if you can have lower costs on these things, then maybe a bunch of people can actually run, you know, a few chips at home, and we can decentralize mining. Do you think that that's the way it goes, or you just think at some point these big miners blow up and there's a way that we can actually decentralize mining in a more productive way?
The issue is the BitAx to me represents an amazing opportunity to introduce people to mining, right? You get to have this tool, you can connect it to a pool, you can connect it to a node, but what's the reality of its actual impact on the network, right? An S19 is what they're deconstructing to make these things. They're getting those little chips from to put them on the PCBs and then sell them. Those S19s contain about 180 or so of these chips. So the next thing is, how many...
I was told 330. But,
oh, maybe
and
it's
each
more.
One, each it's 330. Each okay. one roughly pulls 10 watts. And so the whole thing's like 3,300 watts approximately. Yeah. But I could be mistaken, but it was the guy selling the stuff. So maybe.
No, I would trust him. Basically, these machines have a massive number of chips. And sorry for not having that number correct. But nonetheless, that means for every one S19 that a pool like Mara or anybody else buys, BitAx has to sell 330 units out into society. That's a tall order, just even logistically, right? To ship all these packages and the assembly process and making a PCB for each individual chip, power delivery, setup. I don't think the BitAx specifically is going to decentralize Bitcoin mining to a meaningful degree. No. What it is going to do is inspire people to start getting bigger equipment. Like, I just did this BitAx.
Yes.
Okay, I'm burning 40 sats. Okay, I need to make this order to Bitmain. And they get their S19. Like, okay, let's get a couple of these things. I got a garage, you know. They'll start building it, and they'll start, okay, the next step, eventually some guy's going to end up with the ability to order shipping containers full of this stuff, right? So at the end of the day, that's what the BitAx represents to me, is an introduction to mining that is accessible to everybody. If you want to get into mining before the BitAx, you had a couple of options that were pretty awful. Like, you could pretend to run a GPU miner with BFG miner or whatnot, and you wouldn't get any, you would have no shares. Okay, that sucks. Yeah. Okay, or like, honey, let's buy an S19. I want to put it in the house, right? And then you realize you don't have 220 volt power and all these other problems that come with it, and the thing's a loud cyber hornet. But the BitAx is really cool because of the fact
So what you're saying is you should just buy the S19 and then it's whirring really loudly, and then when you ask the wife if you can have it, you can't hear her say no. Is that
yes.
the solution?
Basically, yeah, you need to do the order of operations correct. Buy the machine first, ask for forgiveness, not permission. But with that said, ultimately, what I'm saying is that the BitAx is a learning tool that I believe will ultimately lead to more people getting into mining at scale, but inherently the BitAx will not scale to the degree necessary to decentralize mining in any meaningful way. And second, the other thing I am not quite sure on is how, like, what is the BitAx connecting to basically mine itself, right? Like, what pool are these BitAx connecting
pool.
To?
Dude, they
it connects to CK pool, and it's the solo, okay, it's the lottery mining. So you can't actually connect. I have my BitAx, and I connected it to Ocean. And you essentially earn, I think it's like 19 Satoshis a day or something, which they can't even pay you out. So you do the math.
Yeah. But you do okay. the math. Going forward,
they actually had these guys in the UK, they had something that was so OP. I think you're going to love it. So they had a single chip BitAx connected to a Raspberry Pi node.
Yes.
And the whole fucking thing was in immersion mining. I'm like, wait a second. You've got a Raspberry Pi node that's in its own, like, mineral oil. I was like, this is so OP. It's so ridiculous. Like, but I kind
of
love it. I was like,
this is cool.
No,
it's cool. That's cool. Cool. That's like, that's nerds. Amazing. And it's probably like a nice little, like, small container too. So that's cool. That's the other thing about decentralization of the BitAx. So you're connecting, you said, CK pool. Well, you're connected to another pool that's handing you templates. Does CK ever decide to basically OFAC comply? Probably not. But technically, you're not in control of the template you're building at all. He's building the templates for you. Your miner's doing the work, and you're submitting shares back. And you get paid out if you find that block, and he takes his 2%. But what's really cool about what CK did is, if you don't trust his pool, you can actually run the CK solo software yourself.
Yes.
And that is the way that you mentioned Walton earlier. That's how you actually decentralize mining with the BitAx, is you run the node, you run the Stratum server with CK solo, and you run your BitAx or BitAxes or S19s or whatever else on top of it. That's how you decentralize.
Unfortunately.
That's how you decentralize.
Unfortunately, it's not that simple, Portland, because we now actually have some ISPs blocking Stratum traffic. So Vodafone, which is a major, I know you're okay, fine, run a Starlink, blah blah blah, whatever. Okay, but there are like these other attacks. Yeah, Vodafone, which is a major. I mean, they're a cell provider as well, but like a major ISP. Blocking Stratum traffic, and so yeah, that I mean, maybe the simple thing is just run a VPN. I don't know, but
think about this.
The simplest thing.
No, think about this though. Mm-hmm. If you're actually using the BitAx in a solo manner, you actually aren't running Stratum outside of your own local home. Your LAN is the Stratum, right? Unless you're running BitAxes somewhere else off site, but there's no actual Stratum traffic hitting your ISP. The only thing your ISP would ever see.
Oh, sorry, it's just for block templates between the node and the miner, is that right?
Yeah, so what happens is like, I'll describe the situation with the BitAx real quick, is that the only thing your ISP would ever see if you actually were decentralizing, quote unquote, with the BitAx and not trusting other template generators to build this stuff for you would be to do it all at home, and they would only see one thing. Did that person produce a block? So they'd actually have to block port 8333 on Bitcoin to stop the gossip traffic. Because once you found the block with your BitAx, right, it would send it off to the Bitcoin node and go, hey, submit block. Bitcoin node goes, block is valid, gossips it to its peers. So you don't have to worry about them filtering your Stratum traffic. Where that's a big problem, though, with that ISP is when you actually don't own the Bitcoin node. And instead, you buy like an S19, you put it in your garage, and you just go, I want to connect to AMP pool with that. There's no Bitcoin node. The S19 needs its work. And what that ISP did was they're basically dropping that traffic. So like you said, Walton, that's the issue of not running your own node, but you could defeat that again with a VPN, that little extra layer you put on top. So you just encrypt the traffic back and forth. And the other thing as well, putting that out there, Stratum V2, which Shores, who you talked to, is developing, that actually encrypts the traffic. So it scrambles it. So they no longer can drop your shares or stop you from mining or connecting your S19 to some pool.
So we're in some sort of like escalating war between Bitcoin and those who want to suppress it. And it seems like maybe we're winning the arms race, and so we shouldn't worry about anything. But I think Phil's got something he wants to share now.
Yeah, we're going to switch gears. Yeah, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about this tweet from Bob Burnett before we wrap up, because we are going to wrap up soon. Pleb Underground's newest clothing sponsorship. That's right, guys. Proof of Ink. And do we have a deal for all of you guys? Everybody gets 5.8% off the awesome gear at proofofink.com using the code PLEBUNDERGROUND. Guys, that's right. We finally have merch. Stay tuned. It's going to be here under their collab section. Right now, we got just a couple of shirts, but we are going to have more. So stay tuned and use the code PLEBUNDERGROUND for 5.8% off. Okay, so Portland, here we go. This is the tweet from @BoomerBTC, Bob Burnett. And yeah, we definitely want to get your take on this. I know a lot of plebs have been commenting, not necessarily about this tweet, but just what the perception is that, you know, Marathon is doing. But anyways, let's dive into it. Something very dangerous is happening. This is slightly technical, but the following is a very important thing for everyone that cares about Bitcoin to understand. I'll keep it as simple as possible. Most mining pools use a payout method called FPPS. Hashers connected to the pool get paid with every block, whether the pool won the block or not. The calculation is based on a formula that looks back at the average block reward, subsidy plus fees for several blocks. The attached formula describes the FPPS method in detail. Thanks for the graphic, Luxor. Mara is mining blocks in which they take fees that are not disclosed, and they therefore cannot be part of the FPPS payout calculation, which is essentially kind of what we were discussing before about that mempool fragmentation. As a result, they deny all of the folks in FPPS pools, 95% plus of the world's hash rate, their proper reward for their efforts. That's some interesting wording there. They also deny all Bitcoin users the information the market needs to properly price block space. Bad shit here, folks. This harms all miners, all Bitcoin Bitcoin users and the overall health of the entire ecosystem. Transparency is a fundamental characteristic of Bitcoin. Mara and those using this service are behaving outside of the ethos of Bitcoin. A lot of very interesting wordplay there. So what are your thoughts on that messaging? And again, I'm not, you know, my stance is that I can see his point, but I also understand that, to my knowledge, there aren't any rules that are actually being broken. So anyways, what are your thoughts?
Isn't ocean censoring Whirlpool kind of transactions outside the ethos of Bitcoin? That's my only comment. I'll pass it over to Portland.
Don't mention that. It's okay. Portland.
But okay, I'll start with my personal opinion on this.
Yes.
That specific tweet stung a lot. And the reason why is because when we were developing Slipstream and I like pitched the idea, right? We're talking about it. We actually talked about FTPS. And for the sake of being very simple about things, it was actually easier for us to just take the payments in band for these transactions. So all the fees are shared on mempool.space. There's no extra money coming into Marathon's back pocket. You'll see that our blocks, when we do mine them with those transactions, do you mind pulling up this tweet once again, real quick?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
No, yeah, bring up this tweet. Yeah.
Let's do it.
So... Yeah, let's. And by the way, like, take a look, I have basically DM'd Bob, and we're on very good footing right now. And as such, I'm not going to try to just blast anybody specifically.
No, that's exactly right. And that's not the intention of this. The intention of this is for all of us to learn and have this conversation, right? Like, this is, we're all, so, yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to read the statement that this is the one that stung the most, because this actually implies us. So two paragraphs down, Mara is. Keyword is mining blocks in which they take fees that are not disclosed and therefore cannot be part of the FPPS calculation. Okay, so let's go into that a little bit more. So go down to the tweet he quotes. Which was Mononauts.
Yeah, okay. Mononauts.
Yeah. Okay, yep, click let's it and then scroll down and see where it says total fees in there. 0.439, right? Bitcoin. Plus 163.40%. That was what the buyer of that block space paid. They paid 0.439. We're not taking any out of band fees. We just tell them put it in band because the API itself can't differentiate these out of bands. I don't know how to keep track of that. So basically, out of just making it simple, well, guess what? We just like, you just pay in band. So that's the way we do everything. It's just all in band. As such, it completely negates that FPPS worry. But again, there's the other aspect of this. The trust me, bro. What if we actually, as Mara, and as you joked earlier, the spook now that I am, what if we're telling you guys that these payments are happening in band, but I'm actually taking even more in my pocket out of band without telling you guys? Well, you have to trust. But there's another element to specifically about the way Marathon does things. That is that all of their payouts for their miners have to go to a single address. You can actually track the Bitcoins in there. And there's one slip up that we had in the very beginning. A client didn't calculate the fees properly for their block. So what we did was, this was a first Slipstream block. We actually had them pay to our Coinbase address. So if you look in there, there's the one time we messed up in the first block where we had them actually send additional money to our Coinbase address. That one technically would have affected the FPPS payment ever so slightly. But after that, there have been no blocks. The API doesn't support it. And we made an agreement as a company. We're not doing that again. It's too complicated, too hard to deal with for accounting. The whole process is messy. We want Slipstream to be easy and unbiased and just, it works. A very simple product at the end of the day. So in terms of the FPPS, like, we're not going to be distorting FPPS by taking out of band payments from people and like putting money in our pocket on the side. Go through the regular service. It's too much work to do that. I don't even have the code to support that properly. And that first payment, I literally had to tell the client, make sure you include it from this input, pay it right here. And that's how we're going to do it. And then from now on, everybody always has to go through this because I'm not going to manually sit here and look and keep track of your money to make sure you paid us. It all needs to be done through the API as simple as possible. So yeah. Okay. Continue on to Bob Burnett's tweet where he's right.
Oh, here, do you want me to pull it up again?
Sure, you can bring it up again. That'd be great. Okay. Did that answer your question to satisfactory?
No. Yeah, okay. No, it absolutely did.
So yeah, you can definitely see how much Mara's making. And if you're worried about anything else, keep track of the Coinbase transaction and see if we've taken in any additional payments. And the ultimate thing is technically you do have to trust that we're not taking money on the side. But I think it should show pretty clearly that all the blocks we've done have such massive fees in terms of percents, 600, 400, and you saw like 160% there. We're taking it in band. So the next portion of that tweet, as a result, they deny all of the FPPS pools, 95% of the world's hash rate, for their proper rewards for their efforts. So we're not actually doing that. But the second question that must be begged, in an adversarial environment such as mining, where these activities such as out-of-band payments have happened before, I mentioned Luxor earlier in this podcast with Taproot, or inscription number 652, the giant Taproot wizard, they took an out-of-band payment for that, for sure. That showed zero fee for basically 4 megabytes of data. Why would miners in such an adversarial environment trust that all the other miners aren't doing this kind of stuff? And why would they base their models on other people's behavior in Bitcoin outside of the consensus rules? It's an Oracle problem they're creating for themselves. Yeah, so essentially with FPPS, miners are paying very consistent payouts based on this like averaging mechanism of the fees paid in the box. So I just don't understand why miners would just blindly trust that everything's okay when mining is an adversarial environment. And as such, they would have to bake in some premium that they're going to keep, like a reserve or some sort of risk-adjusted premium, to ensure that if this does happen, they have the money to pay out the pools, because there are a ton of other ways that miners could mess with each other this way. It's just nobody's done it yet. So I don't intend on us being the first to do that. So
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm done.
I was going to say, so, but technically to me, I feel as though this is, I feel like the, and again, I don't understand enough, but I feel like Bob Burnett's argument is a bit of a straw man, only because, to your point, right? When the FPPS payouts are calculated, they're calculated based on blocks they don't even know that they've mined yet.
Yes, correct.
So
that's
to
all
your
point,
like it's all hedging, so to speak.
It is, literally. That's what the consistent payout is, a hedging mechanism in of itself. And then the other thing is, you want to talk about not being transparent. Look at the FPPS algorithms these pools use. Nobody knows what's going on in the back end. They're just like, most miners go, it's good,
like,
enough,
and I'm
happy.
Right?
It's a basically, and as such, so just putting it all out there, there's distrust from the miners or the hashers to the pool itself. There's distrust between pools and each other. But at the end of the day, Marathon itself isn't actually breaking these rules that are arbitrarily set up by pools and just this community agreed on consensus or whatever they have. It's not Bitcoin consensus, by the way. It's their own payout schemes, and this is the way things work with them. And as such, we're not actually having any meaningful impact. And even if we did decide to take out of band payments, we, like I said earlier in the podcast, we don't have enough hash rate to meaningfully impact the network. They may notice a little bit, maybe a few extra sats go out to these miners, but nothing substantial. Can we go to the last part of the tweet and close that out?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yep, there's one more piece in there. Because he's right on one thing. They also deny Bitcoin users the information the market needs to properly price block space. So I wouldn't say the information the market needs. You can still price block space without it. But yeah, when people do use Slipstream, Marathon, we keep it in our mempool as a private entry, because there's no incentive for us to broadcast it to the regular network. And as an initial test of Slipstream, I actually had Marathon, we submitted these non-standard transactions onto the network to see if any other miners would pick them up. They just dropped it. They didn't get propagated across the network. So what's the difference between me putting that we don't broadcast the transaction, or even if I did broadcast the transaction to the network, to attempt to allow the rest of the network to take the fees that we technically curated through Slipstream? Nobody knows which one's actually happening, because of the fact that these relay policies, back to the point where we started, are the actual censorship mechanisms in place to stop that information from propagating across the network for people to get an accurate view of the mempool. So with that said, if the relay policy was loosened or consensus was tightened, the differential between mempools would actually decrease. But because there's a gap, like I said earlier, think privately. Relay policy is this tiny little box of things you can use. You have pay to public key, pay to public key hash, pay to script hash, pay to witness script hash, pay to witness public key hash, and pay to taproot. You can play with inside this little box, but all of Bitcoin consensus is like the rest of the frame. The relay policy either needs to move this way so that miners can't do this, or consensus needs to move this way so miners can't do that. Pick your choice.
I think it's very well said. And Portland, honestly, I really appreciate you coming onto the show and joining us to explain this, because a lot of discussion, as you know, on Bitcoin Twitter is going on around what Marathon is doing, and is Marathon becoming a bad actor? And, you know, like, so this was eye-opening, and hopefully it clears, you know, it clears a little bit up, you know, for the viewers and the listeners.
Go ahead. You go. I want to, like, on that topic, I do have this little piece of mail I got the other day. We've been working with a specific entity in the Bitcoin ecosystem that is fairly big, and we got approached by them about Slipstream initially because of some of the concerns of, like, what the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. And so we have, like, this little meeting with them, and okay, cool. We go over, like, the actual problems that I patched with Slipstream to make sure people get DOS Bitcoin blocks, etc. And the message sent to the CEO of Marathon, I think that's fine for me to say, it ended with this. This is exemplary and how I hope open source relations with companies in the space can always be. That was somebody that contacted us about Slipstream and all the problems and all the bad that it can cause, and how we handled that. Yeah. And I'm not going to dox anybody involved with that process, but literally that was the final statement. And I'm still in contact with these people about kind of finalizing the little nuances of Slipstream. So for being an attack on Bitcoin, I'm surprised that more people haven't come out and said, like, oh, you guys are awful. This sucks. Like, why did we work with you? You guys didn't accommodate anything we said, blah, 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 blah. And so far, the only actual within the industry negative feedback we have received was Bob Burnett's tweet, which I think we are on a good page now, but initially, yes, as I cleared up, the initial concern was needed a little bit more due diligence. And then second, a person that is a former Bitcoin Core contributor that works at Ocean Pool has stated that they deliberately think that Slipstream is an attack on Bitcoin. Those are the only two examples I've had of just in industry or developers going, this is a bad thing. So
really appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
And unfortunately we do got to wrap up this episode, but no, it's all good, man. But before we do, if anybody wants to reach you, what is the best way to contact you?
The Twitter handle, Portland Hodl, PortlandHodl, 100%. DMs are always open, and I don't filter by verified. So
awesome. Okay, we're going to put that in the show notes for everyone. And guys, this wraps up this week's episode of Pleb Underground. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Help us grow the channel. Don't forget to check us out on our audio only platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. If you want to stream us sats, check us out on fountain.fm. You can stream a sats through Breeze. Walton, how do we end this now that my camera has died?
Fuckshitcoins.com. Please like and subscribe. We will see you next week.
Catch you all next week. More toxic than the most.